crossroads of empires, battleground of the ages, city of peace and of war. This is Jerusalem, where archaeology uncovers the empires of yesterday, where prophecy decodes the headlines of today. This is where history and prophecy come alive. This is Watch Jerusalem.
Welcome back to Watch Jerusalem. I'm your host, Brent Nachtigall. We're not coming to you today from Jerusalem, Israel. Instead, I'm actually in the United Kingdom. I'm here for the weekend. I'm on the campus of Herbert W. Armstrong College right now in their recording studios, and that's located just south of Birmingham in a beautiful place called Edstone. And what we're going to do today, because I'm not in Jerusalem, I'm actually going to interview a little bit later on Christopher Eames in this studio and talk about a recent article that he has published on Watch Jerusalem about the creation and the Genesis story of creation and other civilizations that have a similar style story. So you won't want to miss that. So stay around for the second half. But before I get to that, I just want to talk about a recent lecture I gave to some of the students both here and back in the United States. This class that I teach, where I'm teaching this semester, is just an introductory to biblical archaeology class. And for the first couple of lectures, we look at biblical archaeology as it developed in Israel, the area that would become the modern state of Israel. Obviously, before they were a state, there was excavations that had been taken place for a number of years, going back to the 1800s. And then we plot in this class the change that has taken place in both archaeological method and also the way in which the Bible is used as a source for understanding, as a reference for archaeologists. Now, initially, as we talk about in the class, it seemed that the Bible was used heavily in archaeology, and a lot of archaeologists coming down into Israel or the area of Palestine or this area between Egypt and Lebanon, the early archaeologists were basically treasure hunters searching for artifacts of significant note to come back and house in their museums, be it the British Museum or the Louvre or the museums in Berlin. There was this great desire to fill these museums during this age of discovery with biblically significant artifacts. And so you had a lot of archaeologists come down, and in their haste to find artifacts of biblical significance, in many cases they actually misread the situation. They used the Bible to find certain sites, but a lot of the time, or much of the time, their designation of certain sites throughout Israel was incorrect. And then because of that, as I bring out in the class, you had this backlash to the ancient forefathers, not necessarily ancient forefathers, just forefathers of biblical archaeology, once you get into the 60s, 70s, and 80s, which went the other way and decided to throw the baby out in the bathwater and not use the Bible as a historical source or give it as much weight as they would other ancient documents. And in this introducing this topic, we go through two articles, and I want to just mention them to you today in the first half of today's program, because it is important to realize at your foundation, if you are listening to this, you are interested, obviously, in archaeology. You're interested in the Bible and how it's used in archaeology. But we need a certain level of caution when we read up about stories or artifacts or sites that claim to prove the Bible in certain ways. Now, you don't need to mistaken me by saying that I believe the Bible's false. I don't believe that. I believe it's an accurate historical record. And yet there are people that use it in a way that does discredit the Bible just because of their quick to label some of their sites or some of their buildings or some of their artifacts as being biblically significant when they're not. For example, I mean, I think I've been looking into archaeology for about a decade or a bit over now, And there's probably been three or four stories that have come out stating that Noah's Ark has been discovered in three or four different locations by different teams of archaeologists that really want to find the Ark. Now, does that mean that one of them hasn't found the Ark or has found the Ark? I mean, that's possible. But the fact that there's four indicates that some of them are wrong. And in their haste to prove the Bible, they don't use the scientific method as it should be used. Now, I do believe in using the Bible as a source of understanding, as a text that can help in archaeology, can even help where you dig as well. But you have to make sure then that your understanding is correct. Now, the two articles that we talk about in this class, one of them is called Piety and Patriotism. And this was written back in, I believe, early 1980s. It was published in Biblical Archaeology Review. It's called Piety and Patriotism, Secularism and Skepticism, the Dual Problem of Archaeological Bias. And we go through this just to indicate that you have to still, even though you might use the Bible and consult it regularly to see if you are discovering something significant or if you're digging in the spot where the Bible says something should be found, you have to be careful. You have to be careful. You can't just identify or be tempted to identify every site as being biblically significant, because not everything is. But at the same time, as this article brings out, and I'll just quote it now, it says, "There is a strange kind of self-righteousness, not to mention sadistic glee, among those who assure us they aren't pious, in the sense that they don't come in with a certain bias with what they're in their excavation." And then it writes, "And iconoclastic debate points are often countered by those seeking to be intellectually respectable as though they had double weight. The student of modern archaeology should be aware of these professional in-house games of one-upmanship. Biblical archaeology's search for truth is more like a process than a proof, sometimes achieving tentative consensus, but seldom, if ever, achieving unquestionable knowledge. Data that is reviewed by one mind suggests an interpretation that is often different when reviewed by another. These differences in perspective actually contribute to the process as theories are purposed, debated, and revised." Now, this is true. This is true. Once an archaeologist has an excavation, if they excavate correctly and they publish quickly and they publish accurately, then they are entitled fully to give their hypothesis or their designation of what they're found. And then other archaeologists are welcome to come along and look at it, and hopefully not bring a bias into their own study of that published report. And then they can say whether they agree or not. There's nothing wrong with that at all. And thankfully, that has happened many times. And different solutions have been brought forward. Different ideas as to what has been discovered is brought forward, and sometimes they are correct. Then this article writes this, and again, this is from the 1980s. You might be able to find it online. I can leave a link to it at Biblical Archaeology Review, but it mightn't be behind a paywall. But it says here, it says, "Of course, piety, patriotism, ideology, training, and the opposite expressions of these influence the archaeologist's judgment, just as they do the historian's. In candid moments, every professional archaeologist knows this. The best scholars know about it, this about themselves. Others only know it about their colleagues." So he's saying here that most archaeologists, most historians, they bring a certain bias into their study. And that's not necessarily wrong, but you have to be willing to recognize that you have that. And that if you are proven to be wrong, then you change. You change your theory to suit the facts. That's what we want in archaeology. That's what we're looking for. We're looking for the facts. And we're looking for the best possible solution or the best possible designation of what we find to suit those facts. And we're trying to come into it without a bias necessarily, but it's good to be aware of the biases that we all have. Now, some, and this is definitely the majority now, of archaeologists in Israel have an anti-biblical bias. They have an anti-biblical bias. They don't believe the Bible should be used in archaeology as not just a reference, but as a tool to help them, help archaeologists decide where they should dig. It should be consulted only after excavation has taken place. That's what some believe. Now, there's this other article here I'd like to talk about. This is written by Herschel Shanks. He's the editor of Biblical Archaeology Review. And he wrote this back in 2011, the July-August edition, and it's entitled The Bible as a Source of Testable Hypothesis. He writes this, in the highest, most sophisticated levels of professional biblical archaeology, there is a certain prejudice against the Bible. It exists. It exists, even in Israel. And I would say it exists in Israel to a degree that you wouldn't even expect in other nations. I take as my text a passage from a new book, which, full disclosure, the Biblical Archaeology Society, publisher of Bar, is co-publisher with the Israeli Exploration Society. The book, written by my good friend Ronnie Reich of Haifa, an excavator of the City of David, is entitled Excavating the City of David. It is a magnum opus that will be read and studied 100 years from now, but it does treat dismissively the excavation of another good friend of mine, Elat Mazar of Hebrew University. So he writes in this book, this is a huge book about the City of David and the excavations that have taken place. And of course, the excavation that we're involved in is the excavation of the Palace of David at the northern summit of the City of David, which Mr. Ronnie Reich does not treat favorably at all. In this text that is meant to summarize and discuss what's been discovered already in the City of David, this is what Herschel Shanks writes. One of Elot's crimes, according to Ronnie, is using the Bible as a guide of where to excavate. This is a crime, not just according to Ronnie Reich, but other archaeologists as well. He says, let me explain this or unpack this. As Elot read the Bible, it seemed to indicate just where King David's palace might be buried in the City of David. At least it did to her. On this basis, she decided to dig there. This was highly improper and unscientific, according to Ronnie. When he heard that Elot was using reasoning like this to find King David's palace, he knew immediately that, proceeding in this way, she would certainly find that building. So that is what people say. Just because you use the Bible and you say, well, the Bible says, if I look at the geographic markers that exist in the Bible, and with some deductive reasoning, with some logical thought, this is where a certain building would be, people would say, well, of course they're going to find that. They're looking for it. So it's going to taint all of their findings. That's what they will say. That's what they will say. Then it goes on down to write this. I would have thought that Elot would have been praised for proceeding quite scientifically according to the vaunted scientific method that has produced so much of our civilization. As I understand it, you formulate a hypothesis, and then you proceed to test it, either proving or disproving. Elot had a hypothesis, and she wanted to test it by digging. But you can't do that in the case of the Bible, according to Ronnie. So that's what we have, this dual bias in archaeology. We have this bias in some instances, which I think is largely disintegrated, the bias that sought to find absolute, that thought that everything that was discovered was biblically significant, that was overturned through the 70s and 80s many ways, apart from a few scholars that did hold the Bible up as a historical source. But because of that, the Bible has been thrown out the window largely, at least as being a reference or a use in locating a site to dig. I mean, there's all these biblical minimalists that don't believe that the Bible is necessarily accurate. They do study it. They study it because they know it is the most accurate historical source that we have from those periods. And while they don't believe the events actually happened, the Bible, they even concede, is written in a way that it's written in a way that has a perfect geographic knowledge of the area. The stories add up. The stories in the Bible, most definitely, even to the minimalists, could have taken place in the geographic scene that the Bible describes. And yet what he's saying here is that Elot Mazar's cardinal sin was using the Bible to say that this is where a biblically significant site should be, and then digging. Now, that would sound like good science to me. And that does sound like good science to Herschel Shanks. Of course, this is how you work. You don't just want to dig anywhere. You don't have the resources to dig anywhere. You want to find what's important. So wouldn't it make sense? Wouldn't it make sense to go ahead then and do your research, consult all the sources you have available, and then put your shovel in the ground where you think you're most likely to find something? Now, you can do that. You can do that according to biblical minimalists, but you can't use the Bible for the basis of showing you where to dig. You can use Assyrian sources, you can use Egyptian sources, you can use Babylonian sources, but don't use the Bible. Don't use the Bible. This is what Elot Mazar does, and this is why we have great respect for her. And is it significant then that she has found significant biblical artifacts? I mean, let's just talk about, take away the designation, if you like, of King David's palace, of this this large structure that has been found at the northern part of the city of David. Say it's not King David's palace. Well, even if you say it's not, what she's found there, apart from even King David's palace, is extremely biblically significant, including the two clay seal impressions with two men written in the Bible from Jeremiah 38 and verse 1. You can look at Christopher Ream's article on Jeremiah, the weeping prophet, to look for the story behind the discovery of those. And then you can look at her excavations in the Ophel, where she believes she's excavating a massive structure from the time of King Solomon. Okay, we haven't found King Solomon's name yet, but what else do we find? We find King Hezekiah's seal impression, a personal seal, from him himself. The man himself, the king himself, from 2,700 years ago. That's what we find on her digs. We find biblically significant artifacts beyond disrepute, beyond contestation. Because, I asked the question, is it because she also uses the Bible to help her in her excavation, in designating what the sites are, in her decision of where to dig? It makes good sense to me scientifically to look into the Bible as it is a historical source that is accurate geographically and then decide upon where to dig. That seems like a great modus operandi for your excavations if you're going to be digging in Jerusalem. And yet, the amount of backlash she faces because of that from her colleagues is astounding, including Ronnie Reich. We have an article up on Watch Jerusalem. It's entitled, Using the Bible as Her Guide. Using the Bible as Her Guide. I wrote it a couple of years back. It would be good for you to read it and then form your own opinion. Form your own opinion and decide whether or not using the Bible is smart scientifically. And then you can be more aware of this bias that exists, anti-Bible bias that exists in archaeology. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Christopher Eames about his article on the Genesis story of creation.
This is Watch Jerusalem on kpcg.fm.
Only two origins of this vast universe are possible: creation or evolution. And yet, the existence of a creator and the doctrine of evolution oppose each other. They cannot coexist. It seems many, regardless of which source of origins they believe in, more or less assume their beliefs. Many have also been swept into their beliefs based on the circles in which they have lived or associated. In general, the beliefs of peoples on this most important subject have been established without proof. Could this have happened to you? Is it even intelligent to believe in a creator? Was mankind the product of millions of years of evolutionary forging? Regardless of which, should we accept our views on blind faith? People generally believe what they are willing to accept, and most are not willing to prove either. Is there a way to irrefutably prove either possibility of origins? Evolution has been pushed onto the educational community as if it were fact. But does evolution stand up to an objective examination of the facts? And will you accept the challenge to find the proof of the Holy Bible? Proof in the God of creation? Proof that the Holy Bible is the inspired revelation from the all-knowing, all-powerful maker of the universe? Our booklet, Does God Exist?, examines these vital questions and also the stunning answers. Download or order it for free at our website, thetrumpet.com, today.
This is Watch Jerusalem.
Welcome back to Watch Jerusalem. The book of Genesis is well known for its account of the creation of the world, the first man and woman, the two trees, etc. Many pass it off as an allegory or simple myth. For others, it's a matter of faith. Just how accurate is the Genesis account of creation? That's how Christopher Ream starts off his article that's up on Watch Jerusalem, entitled The Genesis Account of Creation, Just a Bible Story. This is a third installment of this series, which looks at biblical stories and tries to match them up with stories from other cultures that would describe the same event, of course, as these cultures are going back thousands of years in some cases, or 6,000 years in the case of Genesis. There are going to be some differences. But we have Christopher Eames here in the studio here at Edstone, and he's going to talk to us about this article. So, Chris, thanks for coming on the show.
No problem. Good to be here.
So first of all, maybe you can, as you do in this article, just talk about the Genesis account, what it says, because they would be the things we're looking for in the histories of these other ancient civilizations.
That's right. Well, I'll first mention as well, this inspiration for this article came from doing those other articles on the flood, on the Tower of Babel. And if you've got civilization here emerging from a centralized location after the flood, after the Tower of Babel, then perhaps we can find these creation stories spread out as well, these similar stories. And so that's what I go through here in this article, beginning with obviously the description of the Genesis account. We have to get that down first. Many of our listeners will be familiar with this, about how God initially created the heavens and the earth, which were then later plunged into a state of darkness and chaos. And then from out of that watery abyss and chaos that covered the earth, recreation began, lasting for 7 days. God spoke the commands, and various elements of the creation were created throughout that 7 day period. Of course, on the sixth day, we have the creation of man after the creation of the animals. And then on the seventh day, we have the Sabbath created and ordained. And then, of course, we've got Adam's wife Eve, which was formed from one of his ribs, and then both of them being educated in the two ways of life that were typed by the well-known two trees of the Garden of Eden, the tree of life and the tree of the knowledge of good and evil.
So as you say in this article, this Genesis account, the location for it is obviously in somewhere in Mesopotamia, or somewhere in this cradle of civilization, as you call it. So what other civilizations have a creation story that has similar features as that story in Genesis? Maybe you can go through a couple of examples for us.
Sure. Well, I start out with this article with an artifact found belonging to the Assyrians, found around 650 BC, but it is a copy of a much earlier story dating around 2000 BC. So this goes right back to the basically earliest stories that we have thus far found being composed. So we have a really early account here, and it talks about creation from a state of chaos, from a state of many waters, just like we read about in Genesis, a state of utter disorder. Talks about spirit powers battling, and then the eventual creation of man. And there's a section of that tablet, you can read about it in my article. It somewhat parallels the story of Cain and how he came on the scene and his birth. This tablet also references monster snakes, possibly in relation to the serpent of Genesis 3 and the fall of man, as many of our listeners will be familiar with. And then this tablet also references the term the Sabbath. So you've got a great many elements that do directly parallel the Genesis account. And again, like I said, this is an Assyrian artifact, so this is their kind of version of creation, and it also parallels the Sumerian version of creation, very close parallels there. And we know from other artifacts that the ancient Sumerians also believed in an original garden of the gods, hearkening to the Garden of Eden, obviously. They also believed that the land was watered from the ground rather than from the sky, from rain. This parallels Genesis 2, where God talks about watering the land by a mist that came up out of the earth rather than the rain. And what's particularly interesting about the ancient Sumerian accounts is the description of an early being called Enki. And he succumbs to a range of illnesses. Actually, he gets these illnesses from eating either a fruit or a certain flower. He gets these illnesses, and one is specifically in his rib. Now, in order to heal the rib, a female is born named Ninti. And the name Ninti means literally lady rib. Nin, lady, ti, rib. And what's interesting about that, again, is Ninti also has a dual meaning. It means mother of the living. And so if that doesn't speak Eve to you, I don't know what does. Right. That dual meaning there, connection with the rib and connection with mother of the living.
So they are, you said they were a Sumerian one, but then also an Assyrian artifact. I guess the Assyrian one, the Epic of Creation as it's known today, that's in the British Museum. You saw that recently.
That's right.
I suppose on your trip. So you've got two there. Obviously, there are going to be some differences in the account because of the time period that these civilizations have had been, well, how the separation that's existed for thousands of years between these stories. So people should realize that what the history that Chris is explaining here on these ancient artifacts goes on at the earliest 2,600 years ago, probably 2,500 years ago, and they go back to about 4,000 years ago. So you've got a 4,000-year-old artifact that describes the creation of that civilization, or the beginning or birth of creation, and as you bring out, they are just so close to the biblical narrative. You have also some others from the Mediterranean region outside the Fertile Crescent and the Levant. So what can you talk about those a bit?
Sure. Well, I do mention the Egyptian accounts. They have quite a wide group of accounts and carvings that people draw their creation stories from. And we know that pulling all of these different texts from them together, we know that they believe the creation took place out of a primordial ocean, that beginning state was one of darkness and many waters. There we have it again, just very similar link to the beginning in Genesis. One of their early creation myths, they have a few of them. One of them centers around the creator god Ptah. And in order to create, this god gave spoken commands. He commanded the word and it happened, which is quite interesting for people studying into these accounts to see that link with the Bible, because obviously in the Bible, God said it and it happened. So that's quite an interesting connection there. And then there's further parallels for the Egyptians in the creation of man, a description of man being formed out of clay on a potter's wheel. And this brings to mind the biblical account that man was made from the dust of the earth, from clay. But then also the account, like, for example, in Isaiah, where it talks about God being the potter and man being the clay. Then the Egyptian text goes on about giving man the breath of life, which is a direct parallel to the Genesis account, giving that breath of life into the nostrils of the newly formed man. And so you can see a picture there as well in the article online of a depiction of this, of man being formed on the potter's wheel. And then also with the Mediterranean region, I go into the Greeks. There's a lot of different interesting parallels there, more than I think we have time for for this program. But you'll have to check it out with the article. There are quite a few interesting parallels.
And then you go into, in this article, you go through some of the Americas as well, North and South America, and some of the Indian stories as well. Really, it really does point to a common root story. So obviously there's going to be people that come around and say, well, I mean, that's not surprising. The fact that there's a root story does show that, you know, there was an initial creation that took place. But how do we know that the Bible's version of that is the correct one? Is the Genesis account a copy or an assimilation of a number of other of these original stories, be it from different parts of Mesopotamia or Egypt or such? Do we have anything that acknowledges that the Genesis story is the oldest? What are your thoughts?
Well, the interesting connections and links with the Genesis account is that these stories aren't unique to the Middle East. And so several people will point to the Sumerian account and to other accounts like that and say that the biblical account derived from these original Sumerian accounts and such. And if you look all across the world, and like I go into in this article, you've got the Indians in North and Central America and all these other stories and links. They don't so much link up with much of the Sumerian accounts, but hold many links with the biblical account. So you see there must have been an original central true account from which other derivations came, other ideas sprang up. And then what's interesting about this whole idea of creation and these other things like the Tower of Babel and the flood is that the Bible talks about it all happening before mankind was dispersed. So what are you going to have? You're going to have, over time, mankind slowly adapting and changing their ideas. And so you can pick out those ideas that have spread out now across the world and help put them together toward a central account. And you can find the accounts in the Americas, in other places around the world, that point to the Genesis account, whereas they may not so much point to the Sumerian accounts. So it's just natural that you are going to find a lot of these differences popping up. But these clues, at least these clues from these stories, really do point to the Genesis account as having just that common root story there, and extrapolating on that as being the most complete account. The Genesis account is the most complete account that we have, and it's the one from which all of these other stories have certain derivations, not necessarily from one another.
Yeah, it just makes sense to me, and people can go ahead and read this article. I think you'll find it very interesting. I learned a lot from it, a lot of things I did not know or understand what's been discovered already, and the links back to Genesis are startling. If you want to read that, again, the article is entitled The Genesis Account of Creation, Just a Bible Story. Please go to our website, watchjerusalem.co.il, to find that. Christopher Eames, thank you very much for coming on the show.
No problem.
That's about all we have time for today on Watch Jerusalem. Thanks again for Chris. Well, that's about all we have time for on Watch Jerusalem today. Please go ahead and read that article by Christopher Eames. And as you do that, click on the link at the bottom of that article. It's for a booklet written by Herbert W. Armstrong entitled Does God Exist? Because if Chris is right in this article and that all these stories of creation from the Americas back to Greece, across to Egypt, into Mesopotamia, all have a common root, and that common root is the Genesis account, then there are some startling implications to that. Please go ahead and request that book, Does God Exist? Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you next week, coming to you again from Jerusalem, Israel.